Thank you. We've been interested for some time in gastrulation, and if I could have the first slide, please. I guess I pushed forward. So this is the sea urchin embryo, and it has a lot of the things that we've been looking for during our studies have relied on axial signals. For example, the primary mesenchyme cells seen here in the blastocoele require dorsiventral, animal vegetal, right-left signals for making the skeleton of the adult, and they receive all of those from cues that, that are given by the ectoderm that surrounds them. So somehow axial, the ectoderm has to be axially specified for their, these cells to receive the appropriate cues. Similarly, the endoderm, as it invaginates to create the primitive archenteron, receives a whole series of signals along the animal vegetal axis, and recently we've learned also along the dorsiventral axis, which helps to specify and allocate the secondary mesenchyme cells, which arise here at the tip of the archenteron, then the three parts of the gut, the foregut, midgut, and hindgut. So what I'd like to talk with to you today are some of the studies we've done to look at some of the early patterns on some of the early genes that are expressed that appear to set up the axial organization of this animal. Now, if you start out, and the egg is along in the animal vegetal axis is pre-specified in the egg, then after fertilization, the dorsiventral and the right-left asymmetries are established, it's thought, during cleavage. These are eventually fixed, and then that leads to all of the downstream genes that are involved in patterning. So what I'm going to focus on first are the properties that unleash this animal-vegetal specification. Then I'll talk a little bit about the dorsiventral and the right-left asymmetries that occur during these early stages in cleavage. All right, so this is the current fate map of the embryo at the 60 cell stage, and I want to give you a few terms. The primary mesenchyme cells arise from this layer of micromeres, which are in the vegetal plate, and it's been known for a long time from the studies of Kaya Ogasaki, who did some beautiful work back in the 1970s, to show that this lineage is cell autonomous. And it's also known from the work of, originally from Horstadius and also more recently from Eric Davidson's lab, that this lineage has something to do with the specification of the lineage just above. The tier above, the VEG2 lineage, actually is fated in toward two subtypes, the endoderm in yellow and secondary mesenchyme in red. And part of my talk will be to discuss how we believe Notch apparently is involved in allocating this lineage boundary between these two, and I'll show you some of the reasons for believing that Notch is involved in sorting this out. The lineage above this is the VEG1 lineage. It too is split into two different fates. The lower half, the cells become endoderm. The upper half, the cells become ectoderm. And this boundary, this ectoderm-endoderm boundary, is also established positionally, and any cell, any one of the offspring of these for a long period of time can become either ectoderm or endoderm. And the boundary here, at least preliminarily, looks like it may be a wingless-like boundary, segmentation boundary, and I'll show you some of the evidence for that. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the role of beta-catenin, which we've been studying, in establishing both endoderm and later this boundary. So the original idea is the following. There are several possibilities. One, and this is the original Horstadius experiment and Davidson experiment, is that it's thought that the micromeres induce the tier above, the macromeres, to become specified as endoderm, and then these go on to give rise to the VEG1 above and the VEG2 lineage below. Now, alternatively, the there could be an autonomous specification of the endoderm, in that other experiments have shown that if you delete the micromeres, you still go ahead and get a normal embryo anyway. So that while there are signals deriving from here, there it looks like there may be some autonomous pre-specification of the endoderm. So we were interested in trying to figure out how this specification works, and we were helped out by a pattern that we saw with beta-catenin. This is a 32-cell stage embryo stained with sea urchin beta-catenin that Jeff Miller cloned. And in addition to being present normally in adherens junctions, which begin to appear about the 16-cell stage, you'll notice that the beta-catenin is in the nuclei of the micromeres and in the nuclei of the veg, the macromeres just below. By the 60 and 120-cell stage, and this is looking from the vegetal pole, you can actually see the four small micromeres, the eight micromeres, and the 16 VEG2 layers, and it's absolutely specific just for those the VEG2 tier, and it's not in the VEG1 tier. A little bit later, a couple of cell divisions later, we now pick up the beta-catenin just in the nuclei of the VEG1. It fades in the VEG2, and as it's fading in the VEG2, it comes up just in the nuclei of each and every one of the VEG1, but only those VEG1 cells that are going to be endoderm, not the ones that are going to be ectoderm. And apparently it's the position relative to the center of the vegetal pole that dictates which of the VEG1 offspring will be, get nuclear beta-catenin. So then we also learned that there was a couple of papers indicating that lithium has an impact on GSK3. Well, if you treat embryos, sea urchin embryos, it's been learned for a long time that lithium vegetalizes. And we found if you treat with lithium, here's the normal pattern, and there's a 30% increase in the number of nuclei that become engorged with the beta-catenin during lithium treatment, and this corresponds exactly to the number of cells that appear to be converted from an ectodermal to an endodermal lineage. I should point out at this point, there'll be a talk later in the week by Atula Wickramarabi. Sorry, Atula, about your last name. But he will show some activated beta-catenin constructs that and some other genes in the pathway that lead to the notion that it is this activated beta-catenin that is somehow involved in specifying the vegetal plate. We've also done an overexpression to show that with the endogenous beta-catenin that also causes vegetalization. Okay, so this is a cross-section of a sea urchin embryo, a confocal cross-section, showing the VEG2 cells the VEG1 cells containing the nuclear beta-catenin, and these are right at the boundary, just after the primary mesenchyme cells have ingressed. And so we now swing in the experimental phase of this and start to ask, well, is it an inductive signal? We got very exciting thinking, well, maybe it's a Wnt pathway involved in this induction, and in either here or in signaling from VEG2 to VEG1. And so the next series of experiments address this possible signaling role. Now, one of the experiments that could be done, and Caddy Logan in the lab did this, was to remove the micromeres as they're forming. So she watched them, and as they popped out from the macromeres, she plucked them off. And then she stained at the 60 or 120 cell stage later, and lo and behold, it has no effect. The beta-catenin goes into the nuclei anyway, even though the micromeres are absent. The other way of looking at that is a transfer of the micromeres from the vegetal pole to the animal pole. Caddy did this also, and here's an embryo showing the micromeres, which normally have the nuclear beta-catenin implanted in the animal pole. In other experiments, we show this causes an axial or a secondary gut formation, but it's only the endogenous vegetal cells that get the nuclear beta-catenin. So that means that we think that the macromeres are autonomously pre-specified, and part of the specification pathway in making endoderm is the migration of this nuclear beta catenin. When we expand it, we get an expansion of endoderm with lithium or other agents that activate the beta catenin. Well, what about this VEG2 signaling to VEG1? In Eric Davidson's model several years ago, there was this notion that VEG2 could signal to VEG1 in order to specify the tier above that. Does that kind of, is that involved? So Patty did this kind of an experiment. She took the embryos, and this is a sort of an update of a number of experiments that Horstadius actually started 60 years ago, and with the help of modern micromanipulators and modern dyes, it's now a lot easier to do it, although Caddy's quite skilled. And Caddy took off the VEG2 tier and the lower tiers and left just the VEG1 and up here to act by itself autonomously. And then I'll also show you what VEG1 can make if she left behind a single VEG2 cell. So what is the autonomous and part of the embryo. She couldn't find any that make a complete gut. However, by contrast, if you add a single VEG2, do the same experiment, you get a complete Pluteus larva. And she's shown in lineage tracing that most of this conversion into a complete gut and secondary mesenchyme is on the role of these VEG1 cells, which had to have occurred due to a single VEG2 cell signal that signaled all these cells to do that conversion. So that supports the notion that there are signals coming from the VEG2 layer to specify the VEG1, and then that somehow there's a VEG1 boundary set up between the ectoderm and endoderm. So I want to go into a little bit about this boundary. What is the meaning of this boundary? So here's that rim of VEG1 endoderm cells that bear nuclear beta catenin right at the boundary. And I should point out that the primary mesenchyme cells, when they bind and form their ring and begin patterning, they bind right at that same boundary, actually on the ectodermal side of that boundary. So one possibility is that it's involved in upstream signals that set up this boundary that are recognized by the primary mesenchyme cells. We also know that from studies from Mike Firkowitz in Rudy Raff's lab, in the expression of WNTs, this is an in situ of a WNT. It's expressed at a very low level, so he had to use the P33. But here in that same ring is WNT5, that is expressed right at that same ectoderm-endoderm boundary. With this kind of thing, it's difficult to say exactly which cells relative to the ones bearing beta-catenin, but at least there is a WNT there to suggest the possibility of this wingless pathway. So the question, though, is what is the nature of the interaction going on between ectoderm and endoderm? And a couple of experiments have been done to ask that relationship. And to test that, I first have to give you a little digression. We did a lot of studies that we call in the lab gut sucking. And what we do is take a pipette into the archenteron and simply suck the archenteron into the pipette, then clip it off and remove it, leaving with an archenteronless embryo. Now, the sea urchin embryo is so highly regulative that it will completely replace, this is an embryo that is a normal Pluteus larva, and here's the hindgut and midgut. It's completely replaced, even though it had, a few day earlier it had completely missed its gut. And we could take out and move around any part so that there's a tremendous regulative capacity of archenteron. Well, one of the problems we had was, where does this end? How much tissue do we have to take away before we now lose the capacity to replace the archenteron? And to give you an idea how regulative the embryo is, Caddy and I did this experiment where you take away the primary mesenchyme cell. So here's a PMC-less embryo. You let this poor embryo gastrulate, then you take away the gut. So here's a PM-less TMC-less and a gutless embryo. And the next day, the same embryo looks like this. It replaces everything. And it turns out the secondary mesenchyme replaced the primary. The secondaries are replaced by the gut. And as long as there's any endoderm around, it can replace that whole series of, regulate to replace that whole series of tissues. But is there a boundary? And here's the gutless wonder, where when we took away enough of the archenteron right out to where that ectoderm-endoderm boundary, we don't get a gut back. This is stained, overstained with the endoderm marker, and you can see background staining on everything. You get a normal-looking Plutius larva, but there's no gut. So one apparent property of this boundary is that it delineates an inability of cells beyond that to become endoderm. But is that really true? So Caddy did another experiment where we took a little piece of known ectoderm from RITC-stained embryos and transplanted them around the boundary and into endoderm. And they convert to endoderm. So apparently this boundary is serves as a signaling boundary, because the ectoderm cells on the other side have the capacity to become endoderm if in the field, but they don't, apparently because they're on the wrong side of the boundary, or the right side as far as they're concerned. If we take the boundary tissue itself and move it into the middle of the endoderm, what we get are little protuberances that seem to be to indicate that the boundary area itself is committed and just makes a piece of supernumerary boundary at the wherever it lands in the archenteron. All right, so the signaling that goes on at this boundary after specification apparently is the boundary serves to prevent endodermal replacement signals that are going on all the time that allow the hindgut, midgut, and foregut to interchangeably replace one another if they're missing. And that provides a barrier, the boundary that we see where beta-catenin is involved. We don't know the involvement of beta-catenin, but that's obviously one thing we're very interested in trying to figure out. Okay, I next want to address this boundary and the sorting out of secondary mesenchyme from endoderm. And as you'll see, we didn't know this, but we stumbled into it because of looking at Notch. And Dave Sherwood in the lab has been looking at Notch. So Dave made a number of, has cloned the sea urchin Notch. It's very similar to Drosophila in every way, except that the sea urchin is missing the EGF repeat number 14. So there are only 35 instead of 36 repeats. So David prepared a number of constructs that we've injected the RNA in the embryo, one being an activated construct that the Ilaria Ribe showed a few years ago would serve as an activated Notch signal. And this is the dominant negative, where it's just the extracellular portion of Notch. And then we have a number of activated controls where portions of the intracellular region have been deleted and to serve as controls for the activated form. So these are injected in, and here's a normal, the way the normal larva embryo looks at late gastrulation. The active controls look the same way. If we put in an activated form, we get an explosion of secondary mesenchyme cells, an enormous number of pigment cells, far in excess of what we would normally get. And this is at very low levels. If we jack up the amount of the Notch RNA we stick in, we get mesenchyme blastula that looked perfectly normal, but 15 minutes after this, the same embryo looked like this. It just barfed out all of its secondary mesenchyme, and we thought these embryos were dead, but in fact, if you watch these going on, they first of all, these cells migrate all over the place, and most of them become pigment cells. If you stain them for a lineage marker, here's the lineage marker. Here are all the secondary mesenchyme cells. This particular marker stains primary mesenchyme cells and secondaries. And you can see a few pigment cells invading the ectoderm up here as well. So it converts a whole huge quantity of endoderm into secondary mesenchyme. Now, the remarkable thing is that those same embryos that you just saw that were so ugly, after the Notch RNA dies out, and drops down, the embryo regulates back to a normal pluteus. So it re-specifies, remanufactures endoderm. We're not sure where the endoderm comes from, whether it's coming from the cells that had been specified as secondary mesenchyme or from elsewhere. But it reestablishes all of these embryos. Here's one that didn't quite make it, but all the rest became pretty normal looking. This is a normal pluteus. All right, what about the dominant negative form? Well, the dominant negative form acts just in the opposite way, whereas we got an excess and a superabundance of secondary mesenchyme. In the dominant negative form, we get almost no secondary mesenchyme at all. There should be a large number of secondary mesenchyme coming off the tip of the archenteron. Here's one. And laterally, you notice this blastocoel is almost empty. There are a number of secondary mesenchyme cells that migrate throughout. Here's a side view showing normal PMCs, but almost no secondaries here. Here's the normal situation. So the dominant negative acts in reverse. So what we believe is that Notch, during a certain stage in cleavage, is active in sorting out this endoderm and endoderm. The active form of Notch seems to be activating and signaling to make secondary mesenchyme cells, and the remainder become endoderm. Well, can we see anything in staining? The only thing we can see in staining is late in cleavage, where this is the vegetal, what will be the future vegetal plate region, and this is the area that will be the secondary mesenchyme. And what we see is, just before this, there was notch everywhere, all the way around the embryo. And just in the presumptive secondary mesenchyme, all the presumptive secondary mesenchyme cells get these little intracellular vesicles that are very similar to the kinds of intracellular vesicles that Judith Kimball's lab has talked about in the GLP-1 lag signaling. And this then, if we do the activated form, it simply expands this darkened area. Now there's a later notch signaling that comes up later that confused us for a while. So here's Notch in dark, deep blue. Actually, David is colorblind, and so the colors he has to use for his fluorescence look a little different. So he uses Notch in blue instead of, he can somehow distinguish these. So, this is shown to show that the Notch is asymmetrically located to the dorsal side. This is the primary mesenchyme cell showing the ventrolateral clusters, giving the axial symmetry at this point. If you look at the Notch and double stained with beta catenin showing the in the adherence junctions, you can count individual cells, so you can get an exact lineage of these cells. And so Notch seems to be expressed in the endoderm later on, exactly at the endoderm-ectoderm boundary, and on the endoderm secondary mesenchyme boundary later on. So what is this high level of Notch that is through the endoderm doing there? Well, our hypothesis is that it's involved somehow in maintaining this highly regulative capacity of the endoderm during gastrulation. And we have one experiment that supports that notion, and that's this. I went in with a pipette and sucked out the tip of the archenteron, which is secondary mesenchyme, and removed it. So here's before the operation, and Notch only goes up as far as the endoderm, but is not up here in the secondary mesenchyme. Right after the archenteron, the Notch goes all the way to the tip of the archenteron, so this is 10 minutes later. It only takes an hour and a half for the embryo to re-specify, delete Notch from the secondary mesenchyme, and this now secondary mesenchyme will replace not all of the secondary mesenchyme cell lineages. So we believe that both beta-catenin in some respects, at least in the boundary, the wingless pathway are involved in animal-vegetal specification, and then also Notch is involved in the more vegetal hemisphere, or the vegetal portion distinguishing endoderm from secondary mesenchyme. Now I want to move on to a few experiments that address the issue of dorsiventral and left-right asymmetries in the embryo. Now the sea urchin embryo, evolutionarily, the cleavage in the embryo is radial, but the cleavage patterns are not at all conserved. So purpuratus, the future dorsiventral axis, cuts diagonally. There are a number of them that are completely chaotic. It doesn't really matter where the future dorsiventral axis. A few have a situation where the dorsiventral axis actually cuts through so that it separates right and left in the first cleavage. And then there are Heliosideris from Australia that Rudy Raff works with. This is a figure from John Henry showing that the dorsiventral axis is 90 degrees off from the first cleavage. Well, we worked with a species related to Lytokinus pictus, Lytokinus variegatus, and in there, although it's not a perfect right-left separation on first cleavage, there is a bias, and you can experimentally create a situation where there is this first cleavage does sort out right-left and dorsiventral. So we went back and repeated an experiment that Horsatius actually had done 60 to 70 years ago. Here this shows you if one of the first two blastomeres is labeled, here's that the embryo, and here's that blastomere labeled on one side, but the other side is devoid of the stain. So here's Horsatius' experiment. It's a little bit complicated, but Elizabeth McCain did this to try to figure out, answer the following question. Horsatius was able to notice that if he cut after the first second cleavage into a dorsal pair and a ventral pair, that the dorsal pair of this, 70% of the time, the dorsal pair would invert their original dorsoventral. So the two pairs out of this, 70% of the time, one pair would be dorsoventral this way, the other one would be dorsoventral this way, with the dorsal here being right at the site of the cut. And you can follow this by tracking a dye that is put in this way. Elizabeth put in a little piece of dye in oil on either side of the embryo so she could track it. So we went back to try to repeat this because Horsatius had only taken it so far to notice that he got this dorsoventral shift in 70% of the embryos like this. The other 30% of the embryos, by the way, go on and the original dorsoventral for both pairs is retained normally. So we grew up, and sure enough, in our experiments, in Elizabeth's experiments, she got about 70% did this inversion. So the question was, what happens to the right-left anytime the dorsoventral reverts? Now, this may sound like an oxymoron kind of an experiment because you and I in our dorsoventral right-left, if we switch around, both the dorsoventral and right-left accompany one another. But formally, this was an attempt to test to see whether those two axes are inextricably bound in the embryo as they are geometrically. All right, so here's the way that the embryo is labeled in advance, and you can see the dye here and here. If you look at it by fluorescence, here's the dye in the single, and here are the two blastomeres on one side. The other two blastomeres are dark. And what we were looking for in the end was this. This is a Pluteus larva, a late Pluteus larva, showing the embryonic rudiment, which comes only from the left coelomic pouch. So this is an asymmetry in sea urchins in that only the left coelomic pouch normally gives rise to the rudiment that will metamorphose into the adult. And so there's this rudiment is asymmetrically located, and then there's also a hydropore associated just anterior to it that is asymmetric. So Elizabeth grew up a number of these embryos, noted whether or not they were inverted, and how the right-left tracked with dorsoventral inversion. And this summarizes. So she got 70% of the cases she got where one pair had normally the label was on the left side, an unlabeled right side. She got 70% of the time embryos where the label was on the right side, and the embryos in every one of the cases, anytime it flipped, so this was the dorsoventral axis flip, but every time it did, the right-left also flipped. So we could find no case where dorsoventral and right-left are independent of one another. So they seem to be inextricably bound in the embryo just as they are geometrically. Now, Horsatius did another experiment, and that's summarized here, where he went to say, where are these axes fixed? If you go, but later and later and later, when can I reach a stage where the animal no longer regulates and becomes two half right half embryo and a left half embryo. So we repeated this experiment, and it turns out that right at the mesenchyme blastula stage, or just before the primary mesenchyme cells ingress, we see a short period of time during which we have two rudiments, a right and a left rudiment, and then we get two half embryos. And it's right during that time that we can show pharmacologically that this is a normal bilaterally symmetrical animal, and here's one that is confused because we've completely abolished dorsal. If you treat with nickel, what you get is a completely ventralized, there's no dorsal, no right or left, and when it's completely ventralized, these ventral lateral clusters and spicules form everywhere all the way around the embryo. The point I want to make here is that up until the mesenchyme blastula stage, the right, left, and dorsiventral asymmetries are completely fluid, and they're fixed right at that stage. So it's that stage that where we're looking for components that are involved in this asymmetric specification. All right, getting back to here, what I've tried to show you is that there is, in establishing this animal-vegetal asymmetry, there are a series of signaling pathways in the vegetal half that set up these tiers that later go on to allow for the lineages to unfold. And at the same time, when these specifications are going on, the dorsiventral and the right-left asymmetries are also being established, and the blanketer pathways we're clueless about so far. So I want to thank the people who did work on this. Caddy Logan, Dave Sherwood, and Jeff Miller are largely responsible for everything I talked about except for the right-left asymmetry, which were the responsibility of Elizabeth McCain when she was in the lab. So thank you.